Pog-a-groddle-fig. Miss Flitworth sat in her kitchen. Outside, she could hear the despondent clanking as Ned Simnel and his apprentice picked up the tangled remains of the combination harvester. A handful of other people were theoretically helping, but were really taking the opportunity to have a good look around. She'd made a tray of tea and left them to it. Now she sat with her chin in her hands, staring at nothing. There was a knock at the open door. Spigot poked his red face into the room.
"Please, Miss Flitworth."
"Hmm? Please, Miss Flitworth, there's a skeleton of a horse walking around in the barn. It's eating hay."
"How?"
"And it's falling through."
"Really? We'll keep it then. At least it'll be cheap to feed."
Spigot hung around for a while, twisting his hat in his hands.
"You all right, Miss Flitworth?"
"You all right, Mr. Poons?"
Windle stared at nothing.
"Windle?"
said Redshoe.
"Hmm? The Arch-Chancellor just asked if you wanted a drink."
"He'd like a glass of distilled water," said Mrs. Cake.
"What, just water?" said Ridcully.
"That's what he wants," said Mrs. Cake.
"I'd like a glass of distilled water, please," said Windle.
Mrs. Cake looked smug. At least as much of her as was visible looked smug, which was that part between the hat and her handbag, which was a sort of counterpart of the hat and so big that when she sat clasping it on her lap, she had to reach up to hold the handles. When she'd heard that her daughter had been invited to the university, she'd come too. Mrs. Cake always assumed that an invitation to Ludmilla was an invitation to Ludmilla's mother as well. Mothers like her exist everywhere, and apparently nothing can be done about them. The fresh starters were being entertained by the wizards, and trying to look as though they were enjoying it. It was one of those problematical occasions with long silences, sporadic coughs, and people saying isolated things like, "Well, isn't this nice?"
"You looked a bit lost there, Windle, for a moment," said Ridcully.
"I'm just a bit, tired, Arch-Chancellor."
"I thought you zombies never slept."
"I'm still tired," said Windle.
"You're sure you wouldn't like us to have another go with the burial and everything? We could do it properly this time."
"Thank you all the same, but no, I'm just not cut out for the undead life, I think."
Windle looked at Redshoe.
"Sorry about that. I don't know how you manage it."
He grinned apologetically.
"You've got every right to be alive or dead, just as you choose,"
said Reg severely.
"One man bucket says people are dying properly again," said Mrs. Cake, "so you could probably get an appointment."
Windle looked around.
"She's taken your dog for a walk," said Mrs. Cake.
"Where's Ludmilla?" he said.
Windle smiled awkwardly. Mrs. Cake's premonitions could be very wearing.
"It'd be nice to know that Lupine was being looked after if I went," he said. "I wonder, could you take him in?"
"Well," said Mrs. Cake uncertainly,
"but he's..."
Redshoe began, and then saw Windle's expression.
"I must admit it'd be a relief to have a dog around the place," said Mrs. Cake. "I'm always worrying about Ludmilla. There's a lot of strange people around."
"But your daughter..."
Reg began again.
"Shut up, Reg," said Doreen.
"That's all settled, then," said Windle. "And have you got any trousers?"
"What?"
"Any trousers in the house?"
"Well, I suppose I've got some that belong to the late Mr. Cake, but why?"
"Sorry," said Windle. "My mind was wandering. Don't know what I'm saying half the time."
"Ah," said Reg brightly.
"I see. What you're saying is that when he..."
Doreen nudged him viciously.
"Oh," said Reg. "Sorry, don't mind me. I'd forget my own head if it wasn't sewn on."
Windle leaned back and shut his eyes. He could hear the occasional scrap of conversation. He could hear Arthur Winkings asking the Arch-Chancellor who did his decorating and where the university got its vegetables. He heard the bursar moaning about the cost of exterminating all the curse words, which had somehow survived the recent changes and had taken up residence in the darkness of the roof. He could even, if he strained his perfect hearing, hear the whoops of Schleppel in the distant cellars. They didn't need him. At last, the world didn't need Windle Poons. He got up quietly and lurched to the door.
"I'm just going out," he said. "I may be some time."
Ridcully gave him a half-hearted nod and concentrated on what Arthur had to say about how the Great Hall could be entirely transformed with some pine-effect wallpaper. Windle shut the door behind him and leaned against the thick, cool wall. Oh, yes, there was one other thing.
"Are you there, One Man Bucket?" he said softly.
"How did you know?"
"You're generally around."
"You've caused some real trouble there. You know what's going to happen next full moon?"
"Yes, I do. And I think somehow that they do, too."
"But he'll become a wolf man."
"Yes, and she'll become a wolf woman."
"All right, but what kind of relationship can people have 1 week in four?"
"Maybe at least as good a chance of happiness as most people get. Life isn't perfect, One Man Bucket."
"You're telling me?"
"Now, can I ask you a personal question?" said Windle. "I mean, I've just got to know."
"Huh?"
"After all, you've got the astral plane to yourself again."
"Oh, all right."
"Why are you called One Man?"
"Is that all? I thought you could work that one out, a clever man like you. In my tribe, we're traditionally named after the first thing the mother sees when she looks out of the teepee after the birth. It's short for One Man pouring a bucket of water over two dogs."
"That's, pretty unfortunate," said Windle.
"It's not too bad," said One Man Bucket. "It was me twin brother you had to feel sorry for. She looked out 10 seconds before me to give him his name."
Windle Poons thought about it.
"Don't tell me. Let me guess," he said. "Two dogs fighting?"
"Two dogs fighting? Two dogs fighting?" said One Man Bucket. "Wow, he'd have given his right arm to be called Two Dogs Fighting."
It was later that the story of Windle Poons really came to an end, if story means all that he did and caused and set in motion. In the Ramtop village, where they dance the real Morris dance, for example, they believe that no one is finally dead until the ripples they cause in the world die away, until the clock he wound up winds down, until the wine she made has finished its ferment, until the crop they planted is harvested. The span of someone's life, they say, is only the core of their actual existence. As he walked through the foggy city to an appointment he'd been awaiting ever since he was born, Windle felt that he could predict that final end. It would be in a few weeks' time when the moon was full again, a sort of codicil or addendum to the life of Windle Poons, born in the year of the significant triangle, in the century of the three lice. He'd always preferred the old calendar with its ancient names to all this new-fangled numbering they did today, and died in the year of the notional serpent, in the century of the fruit bat, more or less. There'd be two figures running across the high moorland under the moon, not entirely wolves, not entirely human. With any luck, they'd have the best of both worlds. Not just feeling, but knowing. Always best to have both worlds. Death sat in his chair in his dark study, his hands steepled in front of his face. Occasionally he'd swivel the chair backwards and forwards. Albert brought him in a cup of tea and exited with diplomatic soundlessness. There was one lifetimer left on Death's desk. He stared at it. Swivel, 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 swivel. In the hall outside, the great clock ticked on, killing time. Death drummed his skeletal fingers on the desk's scarred woodwork. In front of him, stacked up with impromptu bookmarks in their pages, were the lives of some of the Discworld's great lovers. Their fairly repetitive experiences hadn't been any help at all. The most enthusiastic of these was the small but persistent and incredibly successful Kasananda the Dwarf, a name mentioned with respect and awe wherever stepladder owners are gathered together. He got up and stalked to a window and stared out at his dark domain, his hands clenching and unclenching behind his back. Then he snatched up the lifetimer and strode out of the room. Binky was waiting in the warm fug of the stables. Death saddled him quickly and led him out into the courtyard and then rode up into the night, towards the distant glittering jewel of the Discworld. He touched down silently in the farmyard at sunset. He drifted through a wall. He reached the foot of the stairs. He raised the hourglass and watched the draining of time. And then he paused. There was something he had to know. Bill Dawe had been curious about things, and he could remember everything about being Bill Dawe. He could look at emotions laid out like trapped butterflies pinned on cork under glass. Bill Dawe was dead, or at least had ceased his brief existence. But what was it? Someone's actual life was only the core of their real existence? Bill Dawe had gone, but he had left echoes. The memory of Bill Dawe was owed something. Death had always wondered why people put flowers on graves. It made no sense to him. The dead had gone beyond the scent of roses, after all. But now, it wasn't that he felt he understood, but at least he felt that there was something there capable of understanding. In the curtained blackness of Miss Flitworth's parlour, a darker shape moved through the darkness, heading towards the three chests on the dresser. Death opened one of the smaller ones. It was full of gold coins. They had an untouched look about them. He tried the other small chest. It was also full of gold. He'd expected something more from Miss Flitworth, although probably not even Bill Dawe would have known what. He tried the large chest. There was a layer of tissue paper. Under the paper, some white silky thing, some sort of a veil, now yellowed and brittle with age. He gave it an uncomprehending stare and laid it aside. There were some white shoes. Quite impractical for farm wear, he felt. No wonder they'd been packed away. There was more paper, a bundle of letters tied together. He put them on top of the veil. There was never anything to be gained from observing what humans said to one another. Language was just there to hide their thoughts. And then there was, right at the bottom, a smaller box. He pulled it out and turned it over and over in his hands. Then he unclicked the little latch and lifted the lid. Clockwork word. The tune wasn't particularly good. Death had heard all the music that had ever been written, and almost all of it had been better than this tune. It had a plinkety-plonkety quality, a tinny little 1-2-3 rhythm. In the musical box, over the busily spinning gears, two wooden dancers jerked around in a parody of a waltz. Death watched them until the clockwork ran down. Then he read the inscription. It had been a present. Beside him, the lifetimer poured its grains into the bottom bulb. He ignored it. When the clockwork ran down, he wound it up again. Two figures spinning through time. And when the music stopped, all you needed was to turn the key. When it ran down again, he sat in the silence and the dark and reached a decision. There were only seconds left. Seconds had meant a lot to Bill Dawe, because he'd had a limited supply. They meant nothing at all to Death, who'd never had any. He left the sleeping house, mounted up, and rode away. The journey took an instant that would have taken mere light 300 million years, but Death travels inside that space where time has no meaning. Light thinks it travels faster than anything, but it's wrong. No matter how fast light travels, it finds the darkness has always got there first and is waiting for it. There was company on the ride. Galaxies, stars, ribbons of shining matter, streaming and eventually spiralling towards the distant goal. Death on his pale horse moved down the darkness like a bubble on a river. And every river flows somewhere. And then, below, a plain. Distance was as meaningless here as time, but there was a sense of hugeness. The plain could have been a mile away or a million miles. It was marked by long valleys or rills, which flowed away to either side as he got closer and landed. He dismounted and stood in the silence. Then he went down on one knee, changed the perspective. The furrowed landscape falls away into immense distances, curves at the edges, becomes a fingertip. Azrael raised his finger to a face that filled the sky, lit by the faint glow of dying galaxies. There are 1 billion deaths, but they are all aspects of the one death. Azrael, the great attractor, the death of universes, the beginning and end of time. Most of the universe is made up of dark matter, and only Azrael knows who it is. Eyes so big that a supernova would be a mere suggestion of a gleam on the iris turned slowly and focused on the tiny figure on the immense walled planes of his fingertips. Beside Azrael, The big clock hung in the centre of the entire web of the dimensions and ticked onwards. Stars glittered in Azrael's eyes. The death of the Discworld stood up.
"Lord, I ask for..."
Three of the servants of Oblivion slid into existence alongside him. One said, "Do not listen, he stands accused of meddling." One said, "And Morticide." One said, "And pride, and living with intent to survive." One said, "And siding with chaos against good order." Azrael raised an eyebrow. The servants drifted away from death, expectantly.
"Lord, we know there is no good order except that which we create."
Azrael's expression did not change.
"There is no hope but us. There is no mercy but us. There is no justice. There is just us."
The dark, sad face filled the sky.
"All things that are ours. But we must care, for if we do not care, we do not exist. If we do not exist, then there is nothing but blind oblivion. And even oblivion must end some day. Lord, will you grant me just a little time, for the proper balance of things, to return what was given, for the sake of prisoners and the flight of birds?"
Death took a step backwards. It was impossible to read the expression in Azrael's features. Death glanced sideways at the servants.
"Lord, what can the harvest hope for, if not for the care of the Reaper Man?"
He waited.
"Lord," said Death.
In the time it took to answer, several galaxies unfolded, whirled around Azrael like paper streamers, impacted, and were gone. Then Azrael said,
"Yes."
And another finger reached out across the darkness towards the clock. There were faint screams of rage from the servants, and then screams of realization, and then three brief blue flames. All other clocks, even the handless clock of death, were reflections of the clock. Exactly reflections of the clock. They told the universe what the time was, but the clock told time what time is. It was the mainspring from which all time poured. And the design of the clock was this, that the biggest hand only went around once. The second hand whirred along a circular path that even light would take days to travel, forever chased by the minutes, hours, days, months, years, centuries, and ages. But the universe hand went around once. At least, until someone wound up the clockwork. And Death returned home with a handful of time. A shop bell jangled. Druto Pole, florist, looked over a spray of Floribunda Mrs. Shover. Someone was standing among the vases of flowers. They looked slightly indistinct. In fact, even afterwards, Druto was never sure who had been in his shop and how his words had actually sounded. He oiled forward, rubbing his hands.
"How may I help?"
"Flowers."
Druto hesitated only for a moment.
"And the destination for these?"
"A lady."
"And do you have any preference?"
"Lilies."
"Ah, are you sure that lilies are..."
"I like lilies."
"It's just that lilies are a little bit sombre."
"I like sombre."
The figure hesitated.
"What do you recommend?"
Druto slipped smoothly into gear.
"Roses are always very well received," he said, "or orchids. Many gentlemen these days tell me that ladies find a single specimen orchid more acceptable than a bunch of roses."
"Give me lots."
"Would that be orchids or roses?"
"Both."
Druto's fingers twined sinuously like eels in grease.
"And I wonder if I could interest you in these marvellous sprays of Nervosa Gloriosa?"
"Lots of them."
"And if Sir's budget would stretch, may I suggest a single specimen of the extremely rare..."
"Yes."
"And possibly..."
"Yes, everything, with a ribbon."
When the shop bell had jangled the purchaser out, Druto looked at the coins in his hand. Many of them were corroded. All of them were strange. and one or two were golden.
He said, "that will do nicely."
He became aware of a soft pattering sound. Around him, all over the shop, petals were falling like rain.
"And these?"
"That's our deluxe assortment,"
said the lady in the chocolate shop. It was such a high-class establishment that it sold not sweets but confectionery, often in the form of individual gold-wrapped swirly things that made even larger holes in a bank balance than they did in a tooth. The tall, dark customer picked up a box that was about 2 feet square. On a lid like a satin cushion, it had a picture of a couple of hopelessly cross-eyed kittens looking out of a boot.
"What for is this box padded? Is it to be sat on? Can it be that it is cat-flavoured?"
he added, his tone taking on a definite menace, or rather more menace than it had already.
No, that's our supreme assortment."
The customer tossed it aside.
"No."
The shopkeeper looked both ways and then pulled open a drawer under the counter, at the same time lowering her voice to a conspiratorial whisper.
"Of course," she said, "for that very special occasion."
It was quite a small box. It was also entirely black, except for the name of the contents in small white letters. Cats, even in pink ribbons, wouldn't be allowed within a mile of a box like this. To deliver a box of chocolates like this, dark strangers drop from chairlifts and abseil down buildings. The dark stranger peered at the lettering.
"Dark enchantments," he said. "I like it."
"For those intimate moments,"
said the lady. The customer appeared to consider the relevance of this.
"Yes, that seems appropriate."
The shopkeeper beamed.
"Shall I wrap them up, then?"
"Yes, with a ribbon."
"And will there be anything else, sir?"
The customer seemed to panic.
"Else? Should there be anything else? Is there something else? What is it that should be done?"
I'm sorry, sir."
"A present for a lady."
The shopkeeper was left a little adrift by this sudden turning of the tide of conversation. She swam towards a reliable cliché.
"Well, they do say, don't they, that diamonds are a girl's best friend,"
she said brightly.
"Diamonds? Oh, diamonds. Is that so?"
They glittered like bits of starlight on a black velvet sky.
"This one," said the merchant, "is a particularly excellent stone, don't you think? Note the fire, the exceptional..."
"How friendly is it?"
The merchant hesitated. He knew about carrots, about adamantine luster, about water and make and fire, but he'd never before been called upon to judge gems in terms of general affability.
"Quite, well-disposed?"
he hazarded.
"No."
The merchant's fingers seized on another splinter of frozen light.
"Now, this," he said, confidence flowing back into his voice, "is from the famous Shortshanks mine. May I draw your attention to the exquisite..."
He felt the penetrating stare drill through the back of his head.
"But not, I must admit, noted for its friendliness," he said lamely.
The dark customer looked disapprovingly around the shop. In the gloom, behind troll-proof bars, gems glowed like the eyes of dragons in the back of a cave.
"Are any of these friendly?" he said.
"Sir, I think I can say, without fear of contradiction, that we have never based our purchasing policy on the amiability of the stones in question," said the merchant.
He was uncomfortably aware that things were wrong, and that somewhere in the back of his mind he knew what was wrong with them, and that somehow his mind was not letting him make that final link, and it was getting on his nerves.
"Where is the biggest diamond in the world?"
"The biggest? That's easy. It's the Tear of Ofla. It's in the innermost sanctuary of the lost jeweled temple of doom of Ofla the crocodile god in darkest Hoanderland, and it weighs 850 carats. And, sir, to forestall your next question, I personally would go to bed with it."
One of the nice things about being a priest in the lost jewelled temple of doom of Ofla the crocodile god was that you got to go home early most afternoons. This was because it was lost. Most worshippers never found their way there. They were the lucky ones. Traditionally, only two people ever went into the innermost sanctuary. They were the high priest and the other priest who wasn't high. They had been there for years and took turns at being the high one. It was an undemanding job, given that most prospective worshippers were impaled, squashed, poisoned, or sliced by booby traps, even before making it as far as the little box and the jolly drawing of a thermometer outside the vestry. Lost jewelled temple roof repair fund, only 6,000 gold pieces to go. Please give generously. Thank you. They were playing Cripple Mr. Onion on the high altar, beneath the very shadow of the jewel-encrusted statue of Ofla himself, when they heard the distant creak of the main door. The high priest didn't look up.
"Hey, up," he said. "Another one for the big rolling ball, then?"
There was a thump and a rumbling grinding sound, and then a very final bang.
"Now," said the high priest, "what was the stake?"
2 pebbles, said the low priest.
"Right,"
the high priest peered at his cards.
"Okay, I'll see your 2 pebbles.
There was the faint sound of footsteps.
"Chap with a whip got as far as the big sharp spikes last week," said the low priest.
There was a sound like the flushing of a very old dry lavatory. The footsteps stopped. The high priest smiled to himself.
"Right," he said. "See your 2 pebbles and raise your 2 pebbles.
The low priest threw down his cards.
"Double onion," he said.
The high priest looked down suspiciously. The low priest consulted a scrap of paper.
"That's 300,964 pebbles you owe me," he said.
There was the sound of footsteps. The priests exchanged glances.
"Haven't had one for Poison Dart Alley for quite some time," said the high priest. 5 says he makes it," said the low priest. "You're on."
There was a faint clatter of metal points on stone.
"It's a shame to take your pebbles."
There were footsteps again.
"All right, but there's still the a creek, a splash, the crocodile tank."
There were footsteps.
"No one's ever got past the dreadful guardian of the portals."
The priests looked into one another's horrified faces.
"Hey," said the one who was not high, "you don't think it could be
here?"
"Oh, come on, we're in the middle of a goddamn jungle."
The high priest tried to smile.
"There's no way it could be."
The footsteps got nearer. The priests clutched at one another in terror.
"Mrs. Cake!"
The doors exploded inwards. A dark wind drove into the room, blowing out the candles and scattering the cards like polka-dot snow. The priests heard the chink of a very large diamond being lifted out of its socket.
"Thank you."
After a while, when nothing else seemed to be happening, the priest who wasn't high managed to find a tinderbox and, after several false starts, got a candle alight. The two priests looked up through the dancing shadows at the statue, where a hole now gaped that should have contained a very large diamond. After a while, the high priest sighed and said,
"Well, look at it like this. Apart from us, who's going to know?" "Yeah, never thought of it like that. Hey, can I be high priest tomorrow?" "It's not your turn until Thursday." "Oh, come on."
The high priest shrugged and removed his high priesting hat.
"It's very depressing, this kind of thing," he said, glancing up at the ravaged statue. "Some people just don't know how to behave in a house of religion."
Death sped across the world, landing once again in the farmyard. The sun was on the horizon when he knocked on the kitchen door. Miss Flitworth opened it, wiping her hands on her apron. She grimaced short-sightedly at the visitor, and then took a step back.
"Bill Dawe, you gave me quite a start."
"I have brought you some flowers."
She stared at the dry, dead stems.
"Also some chocolate assortment, the sort ladies like."
She stared at the black box.
"Also, here is a diamond to be friends with you."
It caught the last rays of the setting sun. Miss Flitworth finally found her voice.
"Bill Dawe, what are you thinking of?"
"I have come to take you away from all this."
"You have? Where to?"
Death hadn't thought this far.
"Where would you like?"
"'I ain't proposing to go anywhere tonight except to the dance,' said Miss Flitworth firmly. "'Death hadn't planned for this, either.
"'What is this dance?'
"'Harvest dance, you know, it's tradition. "'When the harvest is in, it's a sort of a celebration, "'and like a thanksgiving.'
"'Thanksgiving to who?'
"'Dunno. No one in particular, I reckon. "'Just general thankfulness, I suppose.'
"'I had planned to show you marvels, fine cities, anything you wanted.'
"'Anything?'
"'Yes.
"'Then we're going to the dance, Bildoer. "'I always go every year. They rely on me. You know how it is.'
"'Yes, Miss Flitworth.'
"'He reached out and took her hand.
"'What, you mean now?' she said. "'I'm not ready.'
"'Look.'
"'She looked down at what she was suddenly wearing.
"'That's not my dress.' "'It's got all glitter on it.'
Death sighed. The great lovers of history had never encountered Miss Flitworth. Casananda would have handed in his stepladder.
"'They're diamonds. A king's ransom in diamonds.'
"'Which king?'
"'Any king.'
"'Cool.'